there's no such thing as being too Jewish.
Thank you very much.
Shalom, and welcome to the Too Jewish Radio Show with Rabbi Sam Kohan and friends, a weekly serving of everything Jewish. We'll have a great hour together today of news, music, comedy, and conversation. This morning, our guest is comedy writer Rob Kuttner, 5-time Emmy Award-winning writer-producer of The Daily Show and Conan, and the author of the new book, The Jews, 5,000 Years and Counting. We'll also have a visit from Tom Price, our expert on the international Jewish scene. Please email your comments to us at 2JewishRadio18@gmail.com or visit us on the web at 2JewishRadio.com. The opinions of the hosts and guests on 2 Jewish are their own and not those of the radio station. 2 Jewish is paid for by 2 Jewish Radio Programs and Podcasts, Tucson, Arizona. And now, here's Rabbi Sam Kohan and 2 Jewish.
Shalom. I saw the film October 8th, The Fight for the Soul of America, last week at a screening arranged here in Tucson at the local independent art movie theater, which has shown some very pro-Palestinian terrorist movies recently. After some persuading by Jewish community members, the theater agreed to a special showing of the October 8th movie, which documents the huge surge in American anti-Semitism immediately after the October 7th, 2023 atrocities perpetrated by the Palestinian terrorists of Hamas. The film, October 8th, itself is frankly excellent and comprehensive. It was released this year, directed by Wendy Sachs, and it is, first of all, a fine work of history. After briefly showing the horrific atrocities perpetrated by the Palestinians against civilians on October 7th, it quickly and carefully documents the immediate and orchestrated anti-Semitic campaign against Israel that began before there was any Israeli military response against the Palestinians in Gaza. In particular, the October 8th movie highlights the viciousness of the university-centered anti-Semitic movement that was directed by a shadowy, well-funded, and well-organized group, Students for Justice in Palestine. That is, by the way, not a nonprofit and also not an official organization that can be investigated. But it is supported by billions of dollars funneled to it by Arab oil countries, by the Muslim Brotherhood, by Hamas. SJP, as it is known, was ready to support the resistance, quote-unquote, after the Palestinian terrorist group's war crime surprise attack murdered 1,200 Jews, Christians, Muslims, and Hindus in Israel and kidnapped another 240 while raping and mutilating others and burning hundreds of homes. As is made clear, those pro-Palestinian terrorist demonstrations were clearly pre-planned. They started a full week before Israel began fighting in Gaza, from which the Hamas terrorist forces had come. The SJP had an entire social media campaign orchestrated for it, as well as a full playbook of how to run the demonstrations, what chants to use, how to dress, how to act all across the country, and in Canada, too. At a time before a stunned and mourning Israel had not yet taken military action, while Palestinian terrorists were still shooting at Israeli civilians in the south of Israel, in North America and Europe and Australia, protesters behaved as if the Jewish nation had already bombed Gaza to smithereens. Of course, it continued from there. The October 8th film documents the incredible failures of our leaders of the best universities to address the on-campus harassment and intimidation of Jewish students in America, the calls for the genocide of Jews, the physical violence against Jewish students, and the virulent hatred espoused and demonstrated over the course of the 2023 to 2024 academic year. Actress Deborah Messing, executive producer of the film, also notes that Hollywood celebrities will stand up publicly for any political cause at all, but that after the worst Jewish massacre since the Holocaust, there were crickets to be heard from the vast majority of famous Hollywood celebrities, including Jewish ones. She felt nearly alone showing sympathy for the victims of the Palestinian terrorist atrocities and the many hostages still held by them. The October 8th movie also highlights the UN's monumental failure to acknowledge the sexual violence perpetrated by Hamas Palestinian terrorists and the abject moral failure of the NGOs and humanitarian agencies to even recognize the massive war crime brutality of the Hamas Palestinian terrorists. Perhaps most disturbingly, the bizarre and horrible embrace by the pro-Palestinian terrorist movement of such ideas and phrases as globalize the intifada and from the river to the sea, Palestine will be free of Jews. That is, the world should condone the genocide of Israelis. Well, that's all made explicit in this film, and the incredible danger that these ideas represent in America becomes evident. Globalize the intifada? Let's see. That means people all over the world, all over America, with their faces hidden behind keffiyehs and burqas, are shouting in favor of bus bombings, nail bombs being planted in cafes and bars, of the murder of children on the street. Globalize the intifada? In the streets and on the campuses of America, they are chanting for killing innocent civilians of all ages randomly, detonating explosives in restaurants and at concerts and sporting events and in parks. And somehow this is okay because it is directed at Israel and Jews? Perhaps the most moving part of the film was the coverage of the horrific murders perpetrated by the homicidal Palestinian terrorists at the Nova Music Festival, where they raped and murdered and tortured and burned to death young people singing and dancing for peace. The Nova site has since become a memorial to the many murdered teens, 20s, and other young people slaughtered, with photos posted of them where they died all over the festival grounds, near their burned and bullet-holed cars. I will take issue with one aspect of the October 8th film. In fact, the elaborate Arab oil states funding the anti-Semitic pro-Palestinian organizations in America were not highlighted. The truth is that money comes primarily from U.S. allies like oil-rich Qatar, you know, Q-A-T-A-R, Qatar. Qatar wasn't mentioned in the movie at all, perhaps because they can fund lots of lawyers who would sue independent film companies. But the longer we pretend that this hasn't been a full-on, organized, well-funded, anti-Semitic campaign to destroy Israel, to delegitimize the only Jewish nation in the world and the only nation on earth accused of not being a legitimate country, even though it was formed by the UN itself and has flourished for 77 years, when we don't acknowledge that all this anti-Semitic hatred is paid for by our Arab oil country allies, well, the longer it'll take to reverse the evil impact of these big lies. It was interesting watching October 8th as well to see on screen so many people I have interviewed on Too Jewish as guests over the years, but never actually met in person before, or even on video. Anyway, the truth is we don't know the end of this story, but I can tell you the propaganda war is far from over. Yes, some university presidents eventually resigned. That seemed inevitable when in front of the U.S. Congress they were unable to say that calling for the genocide of Jews shouldn't be allowed at Harvard, MIT, Penn, or Cornell. Yes, there is now a strong effort to address the viciously anti-Semitic climate that reigns on so many U.S. campuses now. Yes, the diversity programs that saw people of color as disadvantaged so long as they weren't Jewish are being revised, perhaps dismantled. Yes, it's no longer acceptable to deny participation to people in college activities because they were Jewish or Israeli or support Israel. But by some surveys, while something like 75% of Americans over 50 years old strongly support Israel, only 30% of those under 25 years old do. That is a huge problem. There is much to be done. Outside the large movie theater where they showed October 8th to a full house, pro-terrorist protesters marched, banged drums, shouted slogans to globalize the intifada. They were controlled by security and police. They were outnumbered perhaps 20 to 1 this time around. But still, on a weeknight, they were out there, maybe 30 or 40 of them, making noise, shouting about killing Jews, cursing Israel, using their Hamas terrorist-prepared slogans, right here in Tucson, Arizona. We have a long way to go. On a more cheerful note, and to play us in this morning on Too Jewish, here is the prayer for the State of Israel in a setting by Saul Zim. The solo is by the chief cantor of Vienna, Shmuel Barzilai. That was Avinu Shebashamayim, the prayer for the State of Israel by Saul Zim. Our guest here this morning on Too Jewish is comedy writer Rob Kuttner, a five-time Emmy-winning writer and producer of The Daily Show and Conan, author of a new and very funny historical book, I would say, The Jews, 5,000 Years and Counting. Meet Rob Kuttner when we return in a moment here on Too Jewish. We are delighted to welcome the Too Jewish, our guest this morning. Rob Kuttner is a very prominent comedy writer who has turned his hand to a terrific book, highly entertaining, called The Jews, 5,000 Years and Counting. Good morning and welcome to Too Jewish.
Boker Tov. Was that Too Jewish already?
Not a little bit. No, I think it's okay. Boker Or. Boker Tov also. So why now? You've written for Dennis Miller, you've done all kinds of stuff, Conan O'Brien. Why Jewish stuff now?
The Jewish answer is if not now, when?
It's such a Jewish answer.
And the business answer is because I was actually introduced to the project by a mutual friend. This publisher, Wicked Sound Press, was looking to do for Jewish history what had been done for American history, actually, that I worked on the America the Book book with the Daily Show staff. And British history and some other histories as well, and it has never been sort of covered comprehensively and satirically, I think, or at least not in a while. And they were introduced to me, and it was a good fit for my, I think, Jewish background and comedy writing interest. And I also just think, having done it, like, I think Jewish history has been misunderstood very recently and misapplied. And so why not get a good version out there that people actually want to read?
Yeah, I think it's really tricky to talk about Jewish history without sort of sinking into tragedy and to make it humorous. I mean, there's a lot of funny, but did you find that you had to kind of tiptoe around stuff?
Yes, a little bit, and I think it's probably pretty clear why I had to do that. I sometimes played some games with the formats and that sort of thing, or took a little critical distance from things that were really grim, but I also think that it's one of the unique sort of the Jewish special sauce, if you will, to be able to combine the bitter and the sweet together like we just did at the...
Pesach Seder's, right, exactly.
Like, we're kind of experts at doing that, so if anyone can do it, it's us.
Take the maror, put it in the charoset, and somehow make it enjoyable. You know, the famous phrase for all the Jewish holidays from Hanukkah through Pesach is, they tried to kill us, we survived, let's eat. But that's old. You had to kind of be creative in this. What's your favorite new take from your book?
That's a good way to put it. I think the one that really was truly the one that motivated me, especially as I was sort of working on this through October 7th, and it became very challenging to keep going,
right,
was something my editor said, which is like, we've been through worse, we'll get through it, and we'll still be Jews.
In exploring Jewish history, there's so many wonderful moments, and then, you know, as you said, kind of combined with so many challenging moments, but it's also 3,800 years of history. You start with creation, you work your way through the biblical period, but you know, there's just so much. How do you decide what not to include?
That was really tough. I think what it came down to in the end was I had to stick to things that were strictly speaking history. So it meant that, you know, for example, I have like the rabbi action cards. It really kind of gives a very cursory overview of like the rabbis and the whole turn towards rabbinic Judaism and the theology and the religion, really, I think. I had to sort of keep it into a historical narrative where these things intersected with the rest of the world and chronology without going into too much detail. I guess my hope was that it would intrigue people enough that they would go off and research those things themselves, or at least take an interest in them. But I couldn't get into all that stuff, or the book would be endless.
Yeah, as Jewish history can be. We will talk much more with Rob Kuttner. His highly entertaining take on Jewish history is called The Jews, 5,000 Years and Counting. Recommend it. And we will be back in just a moment here on Two Jewish. Beit Simcha, the House of Joy, a fabulous Jewish synagogue in Northwest Tucson in the Catalina foothills, celebrates a great array of services, classes, and events this spring and summer. Established 6.5 years ago by great congregants and me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, Beit Simcha is a vibrant, vital community that strives every day to serve God with joy. Progressive congregation in Northwest Tucson and the foothills, Beit Simcha is open to everybody throughout the Metropolitan area, providing weekly Shabbat services, youth and adult education academy courses, social justice opportunities, outreach, and cultural Jewish programming. Join us in person for Shabbat services or come on Facebook Live. Go to our website, beitsimchatucson.org, BEITSIMCHA Tucson.org. We welcome members and guests in our sanctuary. Call 520-276-5675. Religious school is available for school-aged children or grandchildren. Join us for Torah Tykes experience, Hebrew school, bar and bat mitzvah programs, confirmation and teen programs, all in a fun, relaxed setting with fabulous Jewish learning. Go to beitsimchatucson.org, BEITSIMCHA Tucson.org to sign up. Beit Simcha services, classes, and events are all available on our website, beitsimchatucson.org. You can join us every Friday night, 6:30 p.m. services, followed by a delicious Oneg Shabbat, led by me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, with our Beit Simcha musicians. Saturday morning, 9 a.m. Torah study, 10 a.m. Shabbat morning services, and Torah reading, always followed by a tasty Kiddush. Our Facebook page has our services as well, Beit Simcha Tucson, BEITSIMCHA Tucson. All of our Adult Education Academy classes, including Torah Study, are available live and on Zoom. You can access those by going to the website to beitsimchatucson.org. For more information about Beit Simcha, to come to services, religious school, Torah Tykes, Bar and Bat Mitzvah, confirmation, high school programs, rich array of Adult Education Academy courses, and all of our services, go to beitsimchatucson.org, BEITSIMCHA Tucson.org, or call 520-276-5675. That's 520-276-5675. Join me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, in the fastest growing Jewish congregation community in all of Southern Arizona. If you have a question, comment, compliment, or criticism, a kvetch or a kvel, please email us at twojewishradio18@gmail.com. That's T-O-O Jewish Radio 18 at gmail.com. Or visit our website, twojewishradio.com, T-O-O Jewish Radio.com. You can hear all past and present shows through the website, streaming us from there or downloading us from the Apple iTunes Store. It's a very popular Jewish podcast. Top 10 in America, Current Moment Magazine, over 250,000 downloads on Podbean and on Spotify. Post a rating, review Two Jewish wherever you listen to us. Those comments help. The stories we share last a lifetime and are passed down from generation to generation, known for our compassionate commitment to the families we serve. Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has faithfully served the Tucson community and the Jewish community for over 100 years. We help thousands of families plan and carry out celebrations of loved ones in unique and special ways and assist them in sharing those lifetimes of stories meaningfully. The most beautiful and tranquil final resting place in all of southern Arizona, Evergreen's tall pines shade peaceful grassy fields. You can count on Evergreen for superior service and the highest degree of integrity. Our informative, well-trained staff is here to assist you with a full range of on-site services. Call Evergreen, 520-888-7470, 520-888-7470. While we serve the whole community, our experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox, is second to none. We have sections dedicated to all religious faiths, can help you arrange for your future needs or your immediate ones. Whether you choose to hold a traditional funeral service or a completely individualized ceremony, either in person or online or both, our goal is to help you create a meaningful, personalized service based upon your unique needs in a place of reflection, tradition, and serenity. Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best to the community and to you. Call 520-888-7470. To speak to a family advisor at Evergreen, call 520-888-7470. We welcome our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning, Rabbi.
Tom, you recently came back from the Eastern Mediterranean, which is a fascinating, complicated part of the world and an important Jewish center, a series of interesting Jewish centers that go back many centuries and that I think people are not terribly aware of.
Right. So actually, this trip was a twofer for me. I was in the south of France, showing around a married couple of dear Maltese friends from back in the 80s when I was posted to Malta. Showed them around Provence, an eating and drinking tour, unforgettable. And then I flew to Heraklion in eastern Crete to meet a good friend from here who'd never been to Greece at all. I've been to other parts of Greece, but it was my first visit to Crete. It struck me in both places how ubiquitous the Jewish presence was. And most people, if they think about the Jewish presence in the Mediterranean, they think that it probably goes back to Roman times. So when the Romans ruled Judea, Jews may have spread out through their empire. But in fact, many of these Jewish communities and settlements predate the Romans. Some even predate the Greeks.
Right.
There was a civilization on eastern Crete called the Minoans who had a huge palace complex in Knossos. And I don't know that there were any Jews in Knossos, but I know that there were Jews in Greece when the Romans first arrived there.
Yeah, and in fact, a lot of people think the first synagogue in the world was on the island of Delos off of Mykonos. And it goes back to the second or third century BCE, long before the Second Temple was destroyed.
Right. Also complicated is the question of to what extent some of these territories were Greek or Roman or even Ottoman, because many of the Greek islands that tourists like to go and visit, particularly I'm thinking of Rhodes and of Crete, were Ottoman until the 20th century. So are Jews from these places Turkish Jews? Are they Greek Jews? Are they Mediterranean Jews? What exactly are they? And most of them prefer the narrowest possible definition. They're Jews from Rhodes, or they're Jews from Thessaloniki.
Right.
They're not Jews from a nation or an empire. They're Jews from a particular locale. And many of these locales have very rich traditions that are very different from each other. And not only the Jewish communities, who Jews always find ways to argue and distinguish themselves.
No, I would disagree with that, Tom. I'm sorry.
Right, of course. But
the Greeks themselves. I mean, I was shocked how many of the foods that I love eating in Thessaloniki were completely unavailable in Crete, or in one case, available one day a year on March 26th, some saint's name day, and they, in that saint's honor, eat this thing that I love, and that in Thessaloniki you can have every day of the week. But yeah, there were a lot of things like that that imply there was a certain cultural unity, the Mediterranean lifestyle, the Mediterranean diet, all of that. But there were also incredible diversity. And it's, I think, in those differences that lie the richness of a civilization.
You know,
it sounds terribly pompous.
No, I think the diversity is extraordinary. And remember, while the Jewish communities go back so deep into history in the Eastern Mediterranean, on the islands that are today part of Greece or Turkey or Malta, an independent nation, places like that, they were also impacted by waves of immigration, whether it was the Sephardim expelled in the 15th century and the 16th century from Spain and Portugal, or Jews coming up from North Africa, Jews traveling around the Mediterranean, traders that came from Egypt and so on, from North Africa, you know,
and
all of
that. Him,
right.
As well.
Yeah. So it's fascinating. It also makes the food really good, too, in the Jewish communities there.
Exactly.
Tom, thanks so much. We will continue our journey together next week.
I look forward to it.
It's time now for our old Jewish joke of the week. Jewish humor your Bubby and Zadie knew, brought to you by Too Jewish as a public service. Pacing back and forth, the man was getting really anxious about his operation. His wife asked him, "What's wrong? Why are you getting so worked up?" He replied, "I heard one of the nurses say it's a very simple operation. Don't worry. I'm sure you'll be all right." "Oh," his wife said, "he was just trying to comfort you. What's so frightening about that?" And the man replied, "She was talking to the surgeon." That was the old Jewish joke of the week, special feature of Too Jewish, just for you. You should live and be well. You know, recently I got a shot in my knee and the insurance company said, "Oh, that's an operation. We don't pay for that." I don't know. Anyway, now a word of Torah. This week, we read the Sedra Bahar B'chukotai, a double portion at the end of the book of Leviticus. In these last sections of the middle book of the Torah, there are interesting oddities and lessons, both at the beginning and end of each of these portions. Bahar begins with the statement, "God spoke to Moses at Mount Sinai," a seemingly unambiguous phrase. And at the end of the opening covenantal section of B'chukotai, the Torah reiterates that God gave all the regulations and laws, all the mitzvot contained here at Mount Sinai. Finally, B'chukotai concludes the book of Vayikra by telling us, "These are the commandments God commanded Moses for the Israelites on Mount Sinai." Well and good. These rules of holiness and personal conduct and morality must have all been commanded at Mount Sinai. But earlier in Leviticus, it is pretty clear that God has given most of these commandments not at Mount Sinai at all, but in the tabernacle in the wilderness, far from Sinai, within the Ohel Moed, the tent of meeting, as the people wander around the wilderness. In fact, the entire book of Leviticus is given after we've left Sinai and begun our journey to the Promised Land. As Bahar, this week's portion, begins, the Israelites, they can't possibly still be at Mount Sinai. So what gives? The question troubles the rabbinic commentators who believe the Torah never wastes a phrase or makes a mistake. Their brilliant answer teaches us a profound truth about ourselves as much as about the Torah. In the rabbinic understanding, Mount Sinai is not merely a geographical location, not a simple matter of a place at all. Wherever we learn and do mitzvot, whenever we complete ethical acts, do tzedakah, charity, observe religious rituals with sanctity and meaning, study Torah, or work to perfect the world through tikkun olam, wherever and whenever we strive to make the world a holier, more Jewish place, well, there we are standing at Mount Sinai. Almost literally, as committed Jews, we take Sinai with us, bring God's very presence into the world. It's a powerful message indeed. As we conclude the book of Leviticus, focused fully on creating holiness, we learn that we can make our own lives as holy as the revelation at Mount Sinai simply by studying and living Torah each day. May we remember to do so. When we come back in a moment on Too Jewish, our guest, Rob Kuttner, a five-time Emmy Award winner for writing and producing The Daily Show and Conan, explains why we need a very funny book about Jewish history right now and why he wrote one.
We continue with our Too Jewish update on news of Jews around the world with commentary from Rabbi Sam Kohan.
Eidan Alexander, the last American held by the Hamas-Palestinian terrorists in Gaza, was released last week after 584 days of brutal captivity. The Israeli-American IDF soldier was kidnapped by Hamas October 7, 2023, of course, and was freed after extensive negotiations with Trump administration representatives. Israel was not involved in those negotiations. No further Palestinian terrorists were released in exchange for Alexander. Hamas apparently viewed it as an opportunity to get on Trump's good side and to create separation between Trump and Netanyahu, trying to move America and Israel apart. The liberation of Eidan Alexander was celebrated across the Jewish world, including Tenafly, New Jersey, where he's from. 58 hostages remain in Palestinian terrorist captivity in Gaza. 24 or 23, perhaps, of them are believed to still be alive after over a year and a half of torturous imprisonment in and under Gaza. The release of Eidan Alexander was arranged by an Arab-American supporter of Trump, the Hamas terrorists' chief negotiator, Qatari intermediaries, and Trump envoy Steve Witkoff. Israeli officials said Hamas took a calculated risk. They knew they will only get something between U.S. sympathy and a clear statement by Trump, but it was worth it for them to take that chance. Israel found out about the secret talks about Alexander, an IDF soldier, not from the White House or America at all, but from its own intelligence services. Only when the deal was done did Witkoff notify Netanyahu confidant Ron Dermer and Alexander's family about his liberation. Israel has not committed to a ceasefire of any kind or the release of terrorists, but only to a safe corridor that will allow for the release of Eidan, Netanyahu said. We're in the midst of critical days in which Hamas has been presented with a deal that would enable the release of our hostages. The negotiations will continue under fire during preparations for an intensification of the fighting. Bibi recently said that achieving a military victory in Gaza was more important than returning the hostages. Polls show that the vast majority of Israelis believe the opposite is true. Well, it is a blessing to see Eidan Alexander freed from the horrible Palestinian terrorist imprisonment. We pray that the remaining hostages will also be freed soon. Since the year 1540, a prestigious chain of scholars has held the title of the Regius Professor of Hebrew at the University of Cambridge. But not one of these scholars of Hebrew and Semitic studies was Jewish. Until this year. This September 2025, Aaron Kohler will become the first Jew to join the Cambridge University's Department of Middle Eastern Studies as the Regius Professor of Hebrew. That's a role established by King Henry VIII. Kohler is departing New York City, where he has taught at Yeshiva University, specializing in Hebrew from biblical to medieval texts, ever since earning his doctorate at Yeshiva University in 2009. According to Kohler, it's no surprise Jews never made the cut before. Haha. King Henry VIII, who founded the Church of England along with this professorship, among other acts, intended it for Anglican churchmen to teach Hebrew in the Anglican tradition. That idea lasted until quite recently. 50 years ago, it wouldn't have struck anyone as odd that no Jewish person held the position, Kohler said. It was pretty clearly, not officially, but clearly, meant for an Anglican professor of the Old Testament. Kohler, who spent the 2022-23 academic year in Cambridge, credits his predecessor, Geoffrey Kahn, with breaking the mold. Kahn is not a member of the Anglican Church, nor is he a specialist in the Old Testament, that is, the Tanakh, but he is a scholar of Semitic languages with mixed British, Indian, and Iranian ancestry. In his new role, Kohler wants to promote the study of Hebrew texts over the thousands of years between the Tanakh, the Hebrew Bible, and the modern state of Israel, drawing on Cambridge's rich trove of manuscripts, which includes the incredible Cairo Geniza, the vast collection of medieval manuscripts discovered in Egypt in the late 19th century and first explored by Solomon Schechter. Kohler hopes that introducing students to these texts will open them up to new angles of studying cultural and intellectual history across the world. Despite being the first Regius professor who is Jewish, Kohler said he is wary of narrowing the department around Jewish studies for the Jews. In the U.S., Jewish studies departments tend to attract Jewish students looking to connect with their identity and heritage. This fills a valuable need, says Kohler, but he wants to build out Hebrew studies as a home for any student with a humanistic interest in Hebrew, addressing the same historical and philosophical questions that draw people to study ancient Greek or Latin. Nobody thinks that Greek studies would only be for Greeks, he said. Greek studies spends a lot of time trying to explain to the world this is of universal significance. It's not for every single person, but it's for any given person. They will find something interesting here. I very much want to do the same for Hebrew studies in Cambridge. In other news, an Israeli pregnant woman on her way to deliver her baby was murdered in a shooting attack in the West Bank last week. The Israeli military said that a terrorist fired on cars next to the settlement of Bruchin in the northern West Bank. The pregnant woman, named in Israeli media as Tzila Gez, was wounded and rushed to a hospital where she died. Her husband was lightly wounded. Medical professionals delivered the baby, the couple's fourth. The baby is in serious condition. Israeli forces are hunting the gunman. The attack comes as Israel is poised to expand its war in Gaza since the war began with Hamas October 7, 2023. Dozens of Israelis have been killed in terror attacks in Israel and the West Bank.
Annuncio vobis gaudium magnum. Habemus papam.
Finally, last week, Pope Leo XIV spoke directly about Gaza in his first Sunday address since being elected, marking his first public comments as Pope about the 19-month-old war between Israel and Hamas during his talk. I am deeply pained by what is happening in the Gaza Strip, he said at the Vatican. May a ceasefire immediately come into effect. May humanitarian aid be allowed into the civilian population. May all hostages be freed. The first American pope also decried the war in Ukraine and praised the ceasefire in a conflict between India and Pakistan. This speech, in which Leo proclaimed never again war, and other moves by the new pope are being closely watched by supporters of Israel, many of whom felt alienated by Pope Francis' response to the war in Gaza. Last week, the Vatican announced that the late Pope Francis, had willed his popemobile to the Children of Gaza. That's the Two Jewish News of Jews around the world.
We welcome back the Two Jewish, our guest this morning. Rob Kuttner has an extraordinary resume of comedy writing for pretty much everybody. Dennis Miller, Conan O'Brien, Daily Show. You've kind of done this for a long time for a ton of people. What's been your favorite position?
That's tough to choose, you know, choosing between your children.
Right.
Because, you know, on the one hand, The Daily Show was like an amazing moment in kind of satire where it was kind of the first of its kind, or at least had been around for a while, taking on the media and the sort of official positions of the Bush administration. And that was now a lot. Everybody's doing that across social media, taking on the government and taking on the politics and media.
Yeah,
so that was an amazing experience, but it's kind of grueling in a way. And then Conan was a different, completely different experience where we had the distress of the Jay Leno situation, but then it became a really like joyful and crazy environment. So, you know, like a lot of, you know, happiness, I think in different places at different times.
Your book does such a wonderful job of making Jewish history referable without dumbing it down. You know, it reminds me, there are certain books that maybe they dumb it down a little too much that try to explore Jewish history as part of what they do. The Idiot's Guide to Judaism is, I think, surprisingly underrated. Speaking as a rabbi, a lot of people think it's silly, but it actually does a fairly good job of being consistent about Judaism. In covering topics ranging from the creation to how people feel about their Jewish mothers, did you choose the stuff that was the funniest, or did you choose the stuff that was the most important, or both?
No, the second thing, because, and you know, I mean, like, a little peek behind the curtain is that even when I write a comedy script, you always start with a real story. You always get the drama and the stakes and the characters right before you try to make it funny. At least that's what I do. If you try to go for the funniest stuff, I think you get sort of a tsimis of some things that are funny, but not a coherent product.
You end up with the prunes sooner or later in the midst of the tsimis.
Right, which we could all use during Passover week.
That's true. There are certain periods that I find really, I love teaching Jewish history. History is kind of my favorite bug. Talking about the Jewish life in the Middle Ages is fascinating, but it's very dark. Tell us a little bit about how you brought that out.
So as you have noticed, I go through a couple of different formats of the book where sometimes I take on kind of a first-person perspective or a sort of invented character to tell a story. And with the medieval times, I thought there was so much of it and it was so overwhelming that it might come across a little frivolous to sort of be a person in that time and then sort of have to pretend that everything was okay or make light of the difficult situation. So I switched to sort of my third-person comedy historian's voice there, so that I could really kind of lay the facts out and then just sort of like leaven it with a quip here and there or a little bit of, you know, comedically snarky judgment on the, you know, very terrible actors who were making the Jews' lives so difficult during that period, from the all the way from the, you know, the lowliest peasants who were taking part in pogroms to the authorities who were and the Pope who was launching the Crusades. Like, everyone was involved. And so I just sort of like pulled back a little bit and just told the story and then took shots where they were warranted, I thought.
Just reminds me a little bit of Tom Lehrer's line in National Brotherhood Week after talking about all the different religions. Everybody hates the Jews.
Yeah, it was definitely the trendy thing there. And, you know, some trends have a retro quality like now.
Yeah, they come back. Jews don't know Jewish history very well, do we?
You know, I find that we don't, or at least we know bits and pieces. Like, we know little bits maybe from Hebrew school or from things that come up in like media and current debates and all that. But I mean, you know, even like, for example, even my son who's 12 and the book was kind of aimed at kids his age and older, he went to a Jewish day school for a bunch of years and we do sports and that sort of thing, but he still kind of sees like discrete pieces of it. Like, and so what I was trying to do was like stitch it all together into one tapestry.
I think it's fantastic that you include Benjamin of Tudela and Yehuda Halevi and Abaye and Rabbi, all of these great, I do love those rabbi cards, by the way. I kind of think that was from a Ben Stiller movie originally, but I don't know if you got the idea from that. Tell us about those.
It might have been. I never know where your influences come from. I can't say it was consciously. I would, you know, never lift something from someone else consciously, but that does happen. You know, influences happen. For me, it was more like, as I said, like the rabbis and a lot of stuff is a very kind of tough and dry topic, and my editor actually kind of struggled with it a little bit. I'll let your listeners in on the secret with it. The first iteration we tried was, I called it the Rav battle, where I tried to do a rap battle between the different rabbis, kind of show off. And he said, like, this is too like kind of complicated and clever, and you need to know too much to follow like the raps. And then I tried doing a third person history, like we talked about. He said, this is too dry. So we got this sort of Goldilocks, or if you will, Goldberg locks happy medium, which was, I was thinking about again, my son and his Pokemon cards. And I thought, like, what about just laying the facts out, but also kind of presenting them in a really kind of heightened, over the top format where there are these super massive pumped superheroes. The comic contrast of that with the sort of actually very cerebral, pale-skinned, sitting at desks all the time reading and studying lives that they had, to me, that was a comedy gap that would make it fun, but also at least present the facts in a clearer fashion.
You know, I wish our kids knew more about Rashi and Yochanan ben Zakkai than they do about Charmander. You know, like, that would really be an improvement.
They both went through evolutions, right?
You skipped some stuff because it's impossible not to. What do you wish that you hadn't had to skip?
I mean, honestly, like, not to be tooting my own shofar, but I really put in everything I wanted to. Like,
okay.
in terms of like my agenda of just telling the story as a cohesive whole, like there's so many more places we could have delved into for sure. I mean, you could pick any of those exile chapters and just do a whole book about those. You could do the history of the religion, like I said. I think I wanted to just give kind of a tasting platter of the biggest points. And then, as I said, people would go into more depth. So I think that I covered the broad sweep of it as well as I could and sacrificed depth on purpose.
Thank you for covering Kabbalah and not actually talking about Madonna, so far as I can tell.
Yeah, that was an example of something I thought, like, that's a really interesting part of the story that's been completely misunderstood and not even understood as a part of our history the way it is.
It's
a fringe thing, but not actually a really vital part, like the transition from the Spanish Inquisition into Hasidut and the Tikkun Olam motivation. Like, that all comes from that Kabbalah period, which is not really known.
No, I think that's absolutely right. I mean, what I really loved about this is there's real scholarship all through here, but not in a footnoted, you have to slog through this kind of way. Obviously, it's a lot of fun, and it's supposed to be a lot of fun. If you can make the Haskalah fun, you must be doing something right.
Is this my new blurb?
I'm happy to contribute that. Rabbi Cohen of Two Jewish says, if you can make the Haskalah fun, man, you're doing something right.
And then you have a footnote for the blurb, which is exactly what you didn't want it.
That's right. Because, you know, footnotes have a place, but not when you're, you know, trying to read something fun. In moving us through a variety of really important people, I mean, you include Gluckel Hamlin. I never know how to pronounce her name, by the way. You also get into some of the more contemporary and really interesting sections that are not just contemporary, but that you show some of the depth of it. I want to just touch base about how you explore the LGBTQ plus stuff. Tell us about your choices there.
Yeah, so full credit. So that was, you know, like a lot of the book, you talked about the scholarship. So mm-hmm. You may have thought that I spent like years studying in books, and it's not really true. I had a decent grounding in Jewish history and education, but I kind of took a first pass, and then I took a pass through with Wikipedia for the Wikipedia Rebbe. Helped me kind of get like the facts and figures right. And then I went to domain experts wherever I could to sort of get the story right and really get the facts and get pieces I had. So that was true throughout the general history portions and the rabbinic portions. And then with that one, I kind of like just took the main points from, you know, sort of what Wikipedia and like internet sources did. And then I went to a friend who's a very knowledgeable gay Jewish friend and just said, am I getting things wrong? What am I missing? And he actually helped me find a lot of pieces of it I didn't know and point out things that were really important to that community. So, I sort of had the broad sweep, and then he like filled in a lot of context and details for me.
You know, you do such a fine job of integrating, even if it's, you know, taking scholarship from everybody else. We all do that. We all stand on the shoulders of everyone around us if we want to write a comprehensive book. I want to say, like, for a long time in my introductory Judaism classes, I've used Paul Johnson's History of the Jews, which was written in the 1980s by a Catholic guy, because there hasn't really been a great Jewish history book. I think you have as much content here as you can find in one of those, you know, 700 or 800 page tomes about Jewish history. You do a great job of packing it in without it feeling packed. In writing about Israel, you mentioned how you were working on the book and October 7th, 2023 happened. Tell us how it changed what you did.
Well, first of all, it shut down the project for almost a month. I was about 80% through the book. I was just hitting the 20th century, and I thought, okay, rounding third base, heading for home. I know this stuff pretty well, pretty modern. Just going to slide right in there. And then that's when it all happened. And I just froze, like, really. And I don't freeze. I mean, I'm a late-night writer. I spent 20 years. You come in every day to work, you've got to generate material. There's no deadlines. There's no stalling. There's no procrastination. So writer's block is not a thing that I accept or as part of my process at all. Like, there's no room for that. But this really like stopped me in my tracks, because I was like, first of all, how can I be funny? Second of all, what is Jewish history right now? It feels like we were in this illusion that history had sort of at least slowed down to kind of a manageable pace, and that history wasn't really happening actively, I think. At least that was my bias as a, you know, Westerner, comfortable Westerner, not in Israel, I guess. They probably feel like history has never stopped for them. But it really opened up wide. And so history was suddenly changing. And then also, you know, when you write a book, it's going to come out at best like a year later. So if you want to try to write about what's happening now, that could be irrelevant a year from now. And then finally, what did I think about all this stuff? I mean, everything that's happened since then is so complicated and so multifaceted that even if I knew what I wanted to say and could predict the future, would I even agree with myself later? Did I know what I thought? Like, there were so many things that were stopping me in my tracks. And in fact, I did another section which did not make it into the book in the end, which was, you know, I have this sort of biblical therapy session. So I did a therapy session in the modern age between personified Israel and the diaspora. Like, they were a couple's therapy, like not getting along, going to a therapist. And I gave them personal voices, and they were kind of squabbling about different things where Israel and the diaspora don't agree. And it kept getting into like the weeds of like political differences and also different approaches to things and also like how to assess the current situation. Of course, that was inevitable. And I kept going back and forth with it. My editor had some issues with it. I ran it through a smart friend who I respect a lot, and he had some different issues with it. And then I was thinking about the timeline and about all these things I brought up already. And I just thought, like, you know what? Don't put that in a book like this. Don't try to make a snapshot of the current moment, because right. that will make the book feel dated and maybe not even something that I would get behind later. So you notice I mentioned October 7th, like in sort of two places in kind of other context as something that's part of the history, but I don't dwell on the situation right now at all, because I think that would make a book that wouldn't endure, I think.
Where can people go to find out more about you and to find out more about the book?
You can follow all of my projects, many of which are not Jewish, at robkuttner.com. I'm fairly active on Instagram at robkuttner, and been dipping my toe into Blue Skies, which sounds like that would be a Jewish space. I'm not really on the X anymore.
Can I understand that?
And that's about it. So I keep everything up to date at robkuttner.com, and I post the things at Instagram.
Rob, thanks so much. The book is called The Jews, 5,000 Years and Counting. Toda rabah lecha. Really appreciate it. And best of luck.
Thank you. B'vakasha. It's been great talking to you.
When we come back on Too Jewish, we'll hear about next week's guest get a final musical play out.
The stories we share last a lifetime and are passed down from generation to generation. Known for our compassionate commitment to the families we serve, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has faithfully served the Tucson community and the Jewish community for over 100 years. We help thousands of families plan and carry out celebrations of loved ones in unique and special ways and assist them in sharing those lifetimes of stories meaningfully. The most beautiful and tranquil final resting place in all of southern Arizona, Evergreen's tall pines shade peaceful grassy fields. You can count on Evergreen for superior service and the highest degree of integrity. Our informative, well-trained staff is here to assist you with a full range of on-site services. Call Evergreen, 520-888-7470, 520-888-7470. While we serve the whole community, our experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox, is second to none. We have sections dedicated to all religious faiths, can help you arrange for your future needs or your immediate ones. Whether you choose to hold a traditional funeral service or a completely individualized ceremony, either in person or online or both, our goal is to help you create a meaningful, personalized service based upon your unique needs in a place of reflection, tradition, and serenity. Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best to the community and to you. Call 520-888-7470. To speak to a family advisor at Evergreen, call 520-888-7470. Thanks for being here with us this morning on Too Jewish with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan. Join us next week for another great edition of Too Jewish. Our guest will be Rachel Cockerell, author of the fascinating new nonfiction book, Family, Memory, and the Search for a Promised Land. Our playout this morning on Too Jewish is one of the central Jewish prayers for peace, Sim Shalom, in a beautiful, kind of classic setting now by Max Janowski. My friends, may you have a good week, a healthy week, and a week we pray profoundly of justice and peace.
Too Jewish is sponsored by Too Jewish Radio Programs, Tucson, Arizona.